You are listening to WXRWLP Milwaukee 104.1 FM and RiverWestRadio.com globally, as well as CreamCityMedia.com/anti. Once again, and welcome to The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. I'm your host, NTSC. The Anti, as usual, is anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, and more. If we're against so very much, what do we stand for? Well, the ideals of freedom. In this series, we explore what a free society might look like while recognizing that none of us today are truly free. WXRW, River West Radio, needs your help. Times are tough for nonprofits these days, and especially so for nonprofits like us who seek to engage, educate, and activate the at-risk and the disenfranchised. If you would like to help us out, donate today online. You can join our Patreon campaign, or you can come into the station at 824 East Center Street and purchase some gear, and then wear that gear. Or if you represent a local entity or business of some kind, reach out and become an official underwriter. You can support us. You can support local radio. You can support local voices. And in so doing, we will make sure that everybody knows about you and the good work that you're doing in Milwaukee. Okay, so the last new episode that we aired was episode... Look at the professionalism. I should remember what this was. Okay. Yes, episode 45. We finished reading up an essay that was co-written by a group of libertarian socialists from the Libertarian Socialist Caucus of the Democratic Socialists of America. It was about dual power. And when we first talked about dual power in that episode, I mentioned that there's nothing but potential for people to change, you know. There's nothing but potential for people to improve. And I've talked so very much about electoralism on this show. So what does that have to do with changing? Well, boy, let's just go through here. I've got the list of all the shows in front of me. I've talked a lot about elections. Episode 9, 10, 17... Probably 22, probably 25. And it goes on and on. Well, I'm here to say that I have grown a little bit as a person while making this program, and some of my opinions have evolved. So elections are going to be rearing their ugly heads pretty soon again. And for the last two rounds, at least, I have abstained from taking part. I was very tempted last time around, but I didn't. For personal reasons, I didn't want to concede my personal power to a third party that doesn't know who I am. Someone who's never met me, never will, and has no idea what my best interests are. I didn't want to concede my personal power to somebody who believes that capitalism is a good thing, which is every single candidate that's running for anything. I didn't want to concede my personal power to somebody who believes that the carceral state is in any way functional for achieving justice of any kind, which is basically everybody ever ran for office. No one's ever been an abolitionist, you know, when it comes to imprisonment. But we've talked about harm reduction in the past. We talked about harm reduction in regards to sex work, and we talked about harm reduction in regards to chronic homelessness. Well, I'm just going to have to get over myself. I'm going to have to get over my personal feelings about electoralism and the failings thereof, and I'm going to have to vote. I've talked a lot in episodes past that I think nobody should cede their personal power to a third party. I still very much believe that. I feel like I'll betray myself a little bit, but there is such a thing as harm reduction. I'm in a very privileged class. I've talked a little bit about all the various privileges that I enjoy. So it's a lot easier for me to sit back and go, you know, I object on personal reasons. I'm not going to concede my personal power, but the fact of the matter is there are a lot of populations who do not have the luxuries that I have. We talked a little bit about this specifically in the episode on obesity. The speaker that we talked about said that millennials, you know, have the luxury of being disillusioned with the voting process. Well, I am certainly still disillusioned likewise, but it absolutely doesn't mean that I shouldn't try and do everything I can to improve the lives of those who do not benefit from whiteness like I do, who do not benefit from maleness like I do, who do not benefit from externally appearing to be, you know, straight, you know, who do not benefit from being cisgendered, who do not benefit from being able-bodied, etc. So I need to do everything that I can, and voting, even though it's to some extent a useless gesture, it does certainly have the potential, however infinitesimally small, of reducing some of the harm that can be done to those at-risk populations. I felt like I needed to get that off my chest, because we talk a lot about growth, we talk a lot about evolution on this show, and on the morning show, when I get to dip in with Martin and Joe and Vince, we talk about how you're doing yourself a disservice if you carve into stone this image of yourself, you know, and you say, this is what I am, this is who I believe, and if I change my mind, then it's somehow a betrayal of my character. That's not true. I think that growth, I think that progression are absolutely vital for everybody. And I hope everyone has the opportunity to grow, to evolve on their own terms, and to make up their own mind about things. And certainly, you know, friends and family gave me the push that I needed to arrive at this decision. And I want to thank everyone who talked with me openly, honestly, in a non-judgmental, non-aggressive way. And people who offered me good things to read. Everyone needs to come to their own conclusions, but it doesn't necessarily mean that friends and family can't be fundamentally, you know, can't have a really important hand in kind of gently nudging people towards that. And, you know, I hope that I likewise have some sort of impact on the people in my life, that, you know, I also give every benefit of the doubt and every opportunity to grow and progress towards a future that will be better for everyone. Okay, so now that we've gotten my personal growth out of the way, what is this episode going to be about? Well, we alluded to it at the end of the last new episode, episode 45. We're going to talk about seizing the means of production. This is going to be kind of another off-the-cuff episode. I haven't had a lot of time lately to sit down and do a lot of research, but I don't necessarily think that this episode really requires it. I call the show A Primer on Freedom, and this is going to be very, very much a part of that. Let's consider this part of the quote-unquote coursework of this silly little show. So you might hear the term seize the means of production. Well, what does that mean? I feel like I should touch on socialism a little bit on this episode. So we've talked a little bit about the DSA, right? The Democratic Socialists of America. And there are various people in politics these days who call themselves socialists. They probably refer to themselves specifically as Democratic Socialists. There are so many terms that get thrown around these days in, you know, our contemporary politics that have been completely dissociated from their true meaning, from at least the root of their coinage. And there are terms that have peculiar meanings unique to America, to the American discourse. One of those terms is libertarian. So the last two episodes, you heard me talk about the Libertarian Socialist Caucus, right? Well, libertarianism, as it is practiced and preached here in the United States, is not in any way, shape, or form what that term was, what that term actually meant in the beginning when it was first coined, when a libertarian first emerged from the darkness and said, "I'm a libertarian." Libertarians were anarchists, right, back in the day. They were anti-hierarchy, at least they were specifically anti-hierarchies that are illegitimate or are incapable of justifying their legitimacy. They were horizontalists. They were against the state. They were against incarceration. They were typically against quote-unquote markets, as we would understand them. Anything that creates a power imbalance, they were against it. Well, libertarian, as it exists in our modern political discourse in America, only means kind of what we would call... What the term you might hear is anarcho-capitalism, which is not a real thing, by the way. Anarchism and capitalism are completely opposite things. They're not, you can't have one and have the other simultaneously. Capitalism creates power imbalances, and that is something against which anarchism stands. So, minarchism is another thing you might hear. Both of those stupid ideas are much closer to libertarianism as it's preached here in America, right? So a libertarian, quote unquote, wants what they think is more freedom by reducing the amount of impact that the state has on markets and by reducing the amount of impact that the state has on personal freedoms, right? And generally, all that means is a lot more free reign for corporations to do literally whatever they want with no oversight whatsoever. And, you know, they think that the invisible hand of the market will do all of the balancing necessary to keep corporations from literally killing everybody by destroying the world. That's not ever going to happen. You could get rid of the state entirely, release corporations to do anything they want with no oversight whatsoever except the quote-unquote free market. And you would revert so quickly back to feudalism that we're basically already on our way there, that the state's power has been so significantly crippled over the last few years. Privatization essentially is what they want. They want privatized everything, every grain of sand privatized, every molecule of air in private ownership. And they think somehow that's going to achieve a sort of utopia. And it's inconceivable to me how they think that would actually work. First of all, consumers would have to have any kind of power whatsoever, and they don't. Consumers are nothing more than cattle. We have no real choices in the market because if libertarians fool themselves into thinking that competition is what breeds innovation. You see innovation all over the place today. It's not competition that breeds it. It's cooperation. It's collaboration. It's free association is what actually creates the atmosphere in which you can be creative and inventive. Competition destroys creativity. And let's you know, to say nothing of the fact that in today's modern capitalism, there is no such thing as an actual competition. Having read the book Giants, I'll talk about it again, by Peter Phillips, Giants, the Global Power Elite. Most of the largest companies in the world today do not compete with one another. They have formed enormous cartels because they realize that their best interests are different from the best interests of the consumer. They're different from the best interests of the 99% of the population of this world. And if they cooperate with one another, they can much more efficiently and much more effectively twist the odds of success in this world very, very much into their favor. Okay. So that's libertarianism as it exists here in America. That's not what the term originally meant. The term originally was much closer to anarchism. But let's talk about socialism briefly. So socialism here in America just means, and again, this is coming from a stance of kind of ignorance because I have not really looked into the platform of the two largest, you know, socialists that I hear about, at least, are AOC and Bernie Sanders, right? As far as I can tell, their platform is to heavily tax the richest members of society and use those taxes to create government programs which would somehow magically lift people out of poverty and fix the environment. Okay. So on the outset, it looks like socialism, quote unquote, according to them, is just a really big state, a state that heavily taxes those that have lots of money and then create welfare programs to support everybody else, right? That's not what socialism actually is. Socialism, very simply put, means nothing more than the working class owns the means of production. And that is the crux of our entire episode today. What is the means of production? The means of production is exactly what it sounds like. It is a way by which goods and services are made, right? Are produced. It's the means by which wealth is produced. Production can mean a lot of different things. For example, production can mean creating something in a factory, literally, you know, forging steel. You know, it can mean going into a mine and digging coal out of the belly of the earth. And that's what a lot of people think of when they think of the working class. They think of this roll up your sleeve, typically man, you know, who goes and makes something or, you know, cuts down a tree or has a lot of hogwash. That's not the only kind of labor. The means of production are a hospital where people work to provide medical services. The means of production are a restaurant. The means of production are a retail store. The means of production are an internet company. The means of production are what you use to produce whatever it is you produce. And if you do not own that infrastructure, if that infrastructure is owned by your employer, which for most people it is, then you, my friend, are part of the working class, and you and I have a lot in common. The owner class, the capitalist class, is simply defined by their relation to the means of production, and as much as they own it. Right? They're the ones that own the factories. They own the equipment in the factories. They own the infrastructure that moves technology through fiber optic cable. They own if the electrical grid isn't owned by, you know, the municipality, they own that. Like, that's why large corporations want privatization as much as possible. They want to own everything. They want to own all the forests, the raw materials. They want to own the grid. They want to own literally everything that you need to consume to survive, right? Socialism means nothing more than the workers who are producing own the means of production. So with that definition in mind, whenever you hear anybody talking about seizing the means of production, they are simply talking about some way for the working class to transfer that ownership from the owning capitalist class directly to them. And it has happened plenty of times in the past. There's historical precedent for ways to go about realizing that change of ownership. And some of them are violent and some of them aren't. And some of them have failed and some of them have succeeded. And we'll talk a little bit about some of those examples today in the time that we have left. Let's start with maybe one of the better known examples from history. So, okay, it's the 1900s, the early 1900s, 1914, 15, 16, 17, 18. Those are the years of the Great War, right? World War I. Let's find out here. Russian Revolution. Like I said, we didn't do any prior research. There we go. The Russian Revolution happened in 1917. Okay. So this is going to be one of the better known times in history when a group of people rose up quite violently and seized the means of production. So you got to put yourself back in time to agrarian Russia, right? People really don't give the Russian Revolution nearly as much credit, I feel, as it deserves. And maybe that's because they're too concentrated on the problems that occurred after the proletariat basically seized power and seized control. But you also got to remember that, like, this is a group of poor, hungry, powerless peasants who have decided they've had enough. The war is, you know, crippling the country. Millions are dying, and they understand kind of intrinsically that all of this death, as all deaths in war are, all this death is useless. It serves no purpose but to enrich the rich and maintain the status quo. And especially World War I was entirely a battle of, you know, allies of these superpowers. And of course, the working class had nothing to do with that. The working class never does. They'll go fight and die in the wars, but they'll never start them. So the Tsar was the emperor at the time and was overthrown by the proletariat. And this is one of the most, the largest scale, I think, maybe on par with the Chinese Revolution, the largest example of workers seizing the means of production. It wouldn't last. That's the saddest part of the whole thing. Lenin was famously quoted as saying, you know, kind of, congratulations, we have achieved state capitalism. We have not achieved communism. And it would eventually be Stalin who, when faced with the necessity of, Stalin would eventually have two options in front of him. And I'm not going to ever glorify Stalin because he was a bastard, but his actions at least are somewhat understandable when you view his options. He could either have told the people who had been through just hell, the Russian Revolution, World War I, and all of the events that would come to pass during and after the revolution were torturous on the Russian people. And yet they managed miraculously to pull themselves out of abject poverty and destruction and recreate their country with their own hands, which is a monumental undertaking. So Stalin had two options. He could tell them the truth and say, we have not achieved communism and we need to do a lot more work to get there. Or he could just say, hey, we did it. This is communism now. Everyone just kind of chill out. Which is what he eventually did, you know, thereby cementing the state capitalism of the Soviet union. How did we get here? Oh, yeah. They seized the means of production, though. They showed that it is absolutely possible to storm the gates of power, to dismantle the illegitimate hierarchies that were, you know, crushing them daily under their boot, and to recreate their reality together, non-hierarchically and, you know, communally, horizontally. That's just one very famous historical example. You know, sadly, it wouldn't last, but for this next more recent kind of contemporary example, we're going to move to Greece. We're going to have to do this pretty quickly because I've let time get away from me, as I so often do. So I learned about this originally from Commune Mag. You can read various things if you wish at communemag.com. But this is about seizing the means of production. So, Greece, 2011. There was a company called Vio.me, and all the 70 workers there hadn't been paid in a long time because the industrial capitalist that owned the chemical manufacturing plant was going to face bankruptcy and so stopped paying them. So initially, they just went on strike because they were owed, you know, millions of euros in back salaries and compensation. 1.5 million euros to be exact. The strike would eventually in 2012 kind of develop a new intention that was arrived at democratically. The workers would occupy the factory entirely. They would control it democratically with workers' committees, and they would restart production themselves. And the really cool thing about that too is they got to redefine everything about their work. So originally they made construction chemicals, but the community around the factory really hated all of the pollution and the terrible smell from that. So using the means of production that they seized and deciding to change their business democratically, the 70 workers that occupied and took over the factory decided that they were going to use the means of production in that factory to produce environmentally friendly soaps and other sustainable cleaning products. So not only did they take control of the means of the production, they immediately and directly repurposed it to be more equitable, safer, and better for the entire community, which is something that a capitalist would never do. Capitalists don't give a crap about the surrounding community. Look at your typical factory farm. Okay, so it's easier said than done in this, you know, in this world, and perhaps these Greek workers had a better opportunity because Greece itself is kind of experiencing, you know, a huge resurgence of working class power. But seizing the means of production is entirely achievable. Anybody in any place of work around the world can decide that they've had enough of illegitimate hierarchies and decide that together they will unionize, they will strike, they will occupy their places of work and eventually take control for themselves. We could do it if we wanted to today. It'll take bravery like so many things, but to make this new world, we've got to be brave and take risks and no longer just sit back and ask for permission. Thank you so much for tuning into The Anti this week. I've been your host, NTSC, and I will be back again next week to talk about topics pertaining to freedom and our awesome shared potential. More about the show can be learned at riverwestradio.com, and past episodes can be found at creamcitymedia.com/anti. We'll probably talk more about this next week.